Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, not all communities are on board with large solar farms, even with the cost and clean energy benefits. But up front, families, service providers, and advocates are drawing attention to a state policy change that could leave thousands of children with autism without their regular therapy. Children with autism often participate in therapy called applied behavior analysis. Proponents say it helps those children reach milestones such as communicating and interacting with others. Under the policy change, children who attend regular therapy at clinics will no longer be able to have those services paid for by federal medical assistance. Joining us today, Michelle DeMarsh, founder of the Pennsylvania Autism Action Center, Kathleen Bailey-Stengel, CEO of Neurabilities, and Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, who has reported on this story. I want to thank the three of you for being on today's program.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Brett Schultes, as I mentioned, you covered this story, actually broke this story, I think, across the state. What kind of services are children losing access to under this policy change?
Yeah, good morning, Scott. So the main service that's at of discussion in my story and what I think we're going to be talking about today would be a type of treatment called applied behavior analysis that is frequently used for children who have autism. And it's a one-on-one therapy or treatment that that can occur in the home. It can also occur at clinics or centers. And it's used, you know, the families I've talked to, the parents I've talked to, it's used to help children meet goals that many of us would just take for granted, Scott. Things that could be as simple as being able to communicate either verbally or communicate with a device, being able to express what you need or want, maybe things like learning to use the bathroom, learning to do other things that make it much, allow you to function, for example, in a school setting. And these help children who may have pretty significant autism spectrum diagnosis, as well as things like a global developmental delay. Helps them to be able to meet those milestones and then go maybe go to school, maybe have more independence in their lives as they develop and get older. So it's one type of therapy that's frequently used. And, you know, consider keeping in mind that I think it's about 1.8% of the population has an autism spectrum diagnosis. So it affects it's used by a lot of children, and a lot of children apparently benefit from it. It does, you know, it's not without some critics who would rather use a different type of treatment, but it certainly is a well used and frequently used treatment.
Michelle DeMarsh, you're the founder of the Pennsylvania Autism Action Center. If you could just follow up on that a little bit, how often is this used with some of your clients? And can you explain maybe a little bit more beyond what Brett has laid out for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the kids that come to my center do start out center-based because we're able to modify the environment to best teach that child. And that's not always possible at home. When you're at home, as you know, there's dogs barking and the plumber's knocking on the door, and that distracts from the therapy, and it's a very intensive therapy. So when we're able to bring it into our center, we can modify our environment and stop those distractions and be able to really focus on giving the kids that we work with the skills they need. That being said, we then want them to generalize it in the school, at a club, in the community, at home, after that. But when they're little and they're starting out and we're teaching those basic skills, those beginner skills, the center, for our experience, has been the best place to do that. So that's why we think center-based is so important. So we're primarily center-based, and the kids that we do see in homes or at school are kids that have kind of graduated from our center program and are at the next step where they generalize the skills.
You know, there are about 100,000 children on the who have been diagnosed on the autism spectrum living here in Pennsylvania. Something you just mentioned, Michelle, and I wanted to explore it a little bit further. You talked about distractions like the dog barking or the plumber knocking on the door. I mean, for most people, that's a normal day. For a child living with autism, that distraction, how important or how significant is that?
Well, depending on the circumstances, it can be a huge, you know, distraction and taking away from that moment where we're trying to teach that skill. And perhaps in home, we're often working directly with the parents as well, which is wonderful. But parents don't always have the opportunity to be giving 20 hours of their time to focus on that. When they have other children, they have to, you know, make the lunches, do things that they would normally do in their typical day as well. And that child needs that intensive therapy for 10, 20, 30, even 40 hours for some kiddos, depending on, you know, what the assessments read at the beginning is what they need. And so it can take away from the time it takes. So for example, in the center, we really can help these kids get kindergarten ready. That's our goal. We always say we're trying to get them to the best point we can for kindergarten. When they're at home, it takes longer to learn the skill because of these distractions. Hence, they might not get as far as they could in the center for that goal of kindergarten ready.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen Stengel, I'm going to ask you kind of the same question. Why do you feel this therapy is so important?
Well, thank you, Scott. I just want to make one thing clear about the ABA therapy specifically. The CDC recommends that ABA is one of the highest evidence-based practices, and it has been around for a number of years, going all the way back to early 80s and forward. Part of the treatment is to provide a controlled environment and discrete settings. And what I mean by that is children with autism have to learn how to, first and foremost, focus. One of the basic skills that we teach a two-year-old who is newly diagnosed is to just gaze in our direction. So even just body positioning towards somebody who is speaking. And we call it the learning to learn skills. So for very early on, children with autism require this type of treatment because they learn differently. They don't learn in the same type of setting and the same type of modalities that typically developing individuals do. They need kind of isolation and some type of controlled interaction to isolate specific skills and remediate them. We teach, you know, individual eye contact. We teach sitting, looking at the speaker so that by the time, like Michelle said, they get to kindergarten, they can actually access their learning. So ABA therapy is individualized for the child and very, very specific to not only the child, but also the family dynamic. And it is a very positive, proactive teaching methodology. And what we see is that skills accelerate up when using the basic principles of positive reinforcement and breaking down skills into fine, manageable components, and then scaffolding them up so that the child eventually, you know, becomes an adult who is fully functioning member of society as much as they possibly can. You see, you know, autism is, they call it a spectrum disorder for a reason. We have individuals who are very, what we call highly functioning, but we also have low functioning individuals, and ABA allows us to break the skills down for everyone across the spectrum and isolate different variables to attempt to remediate and build skills. And like Michelle said, very early on, it is difficult to do that in a in an uncontrolled environment. And I think a lot of parents listening who have homeschooled their kids for the past year can empathize. We are expecting parents to be therapists. And I went to school for a number of years in order to actually interact with children with autism and learn how to do this. It's very difficult to put that burden on the families and say that in a home setting is the only way that this treatment can be done. That's just incorrect.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about what the pandemic has done in just a few minutes, but I want to bring some more context into what we're discussing today. Brett, the state was proposing this change to take effect January 17th, which was last weekend. Did it take effect?
Well, Scott, that is a great question because the state says it is putting out new guidance soon and that it will have an update on this front. Part of the problem here, as I understand it, from my conversations both with parents and also with the providers, people like Kathleen and Michelle, is that the guidance hasn't been clear enough, and that's what's causing the concern that that two things will happen. One would be that children who are already getting these services at these clinics and centers would suddenly no longer be able to get them through medical assistance. And the second being that new clients would not be able to get into that system under the proposed change. I want to step back a little bit because I think it can get a little bit process oriented and confusing, and we can lose sight of what's really at stake and what's going on in the bigger picture. What happened here was that in 2016. The state settled a suit with a group called Disability Rights Network that was saying that it wasn't providing all the services it was supposed to provide through federal law. You have to remember that when a child gets an autism spectrum diagnosis, they are afforded certain rights and certain types of care through the Medicaid and medical assistance programs. So there's a lot of precedent that says that if your child has that diagnosis that you know the family shouldn't have to pay for a lot of those services out of their own insurance. Of course, this can be quite expensive.
How expensive, Brett?
The state set up this. Well, we know the Department of Human Services is the largest single chunk of the state budget, and much of that money comes through the federal level. But I would have to get back to you with that exact number because I'm not
okay.
Sure how it breaks
all right,
down
go ahead.
Specifically. Yeah, that's a great question. They said that the change would take effect. It was going to be last year. Then they moved it forward to this year. But you know, when I talk to the providers, and I'm sure Kathleen and Michelle can weigh on this as well, it seemed that there was either confusion or either a misunderstanding or potentially an effort to I don't want to say that I know intent, but one result of this policy change would be that more children would be given services through a different category, which means that it might save money save the state money, but it might also drop some children off the rules of individual care. So hopefully I haven't added confusion, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it is Inauguration Day, and we will be discussing President-elect, then-President Joe Biden, first 100 days, and I'm not going to even narrow it down to 100 days. Put it this way, the new president's priorities coming up during his administration. That's part of tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. Joining us during this portion of today's program is Brett Shultes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, Michelle DeMarsh, founder of the Pennsylvania Autism Action Center, and Kathleen Bailey-Stengel, CEO of Norabilities. We're talking about a proposed change in Pennsylvania that a certain type of therapy, individual therapy for children with autism that would be not paid for by Medicaid dollars, or excuse me, yeah, Medicare dollars from the, put it this way, medical assistance from the federal government, put it that way. That's the easiest way to put it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Got an email here from someone in the know. Says the Deputy Secretary for the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services sent out an explanation that seems to say that the service in question could still be offered in group settings. Wanted to know about that. And Kathleen Stengel, let me ask you about that. One of the things that you've talked about and Michelle have talked about is that this is individualized. Would it be effective, this therapy, be effective in group settings?
So that's a difficult question to answer. Yes, it is effective in group settings. But what we have to back up here and talk about is the determination for treatment. We call it medical necessity. So children get diagnoses and then treatment defined on what their individual needs are. And that's the spirit of the law. That's the federal mandate that it's one-on-one or it's individualized treatment. And in some cases, that means one-on-one. And in some cases, it means two-on-one and in a group setting. For example, you know, individuals who are working on social skills as part of their treatment plan, it makes a lot of sense to have more than just one person, you know, or a therapist in there. The group makes a lot of sense. So ABA can be used with both group as well as individual. What OMSAS, which is the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, has said, they're reading the regulations, the new regulations, and they're interpreting them that only center-based services can only be provided through group, you know, the category of group, and that in fact there is a way that we can bill out for a group of one, which sounds kind of a little bit awkward. You know, we're having group services, but the group is really one-on-one services. So it gets a little bit confusing, but it seems as though that clinic-based services weren't really well thought out. And that they're trying to, you know, put them into one category of group. That would be fine if, in fact, it made sense for the individual's treatment goals. And in most cases, my early learners, those who learned very early on, you know, ages 2 through 6, they need that one-on-one treatment. Yes, there might be other individuals that we rotate in and we create, you know, what we call as in vitro treatment, where we mock different types of classroom environments and remediate skills. But that is not in a group type setting, quote unquote. It really is individualized. And then group comes and we introduce more individuals later on to generalize that skill set and start to work with other individuals. So while OMSAS is saying, yes, we can provide clinic-based services under the group umbrella, that would work if, in fact, we can say, you know, one-on-one services is a group of one. But it gets very confusing for families. And I think part of the problem is there hasn't been clarity. There hasn't been an interpretation of the regulations, and they haven't been implemented, even though they came out last year into this year. So it's kind of a non-answer to your question, Scott. Yes,
not
it can
really
be provided that way, but it can.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I just said not really. I because you anticipated kind of my next question, even for Brett. Brett, I'm hearing words like interpret and seems to be. How can a policy change be that unclear that the professionals are confused about what it's actually saying?
Right, Scott. I think this is why this started to interest me as a potential story. You know, I've done stories before on people who work or in the autism community, and one thing I know is every parent who has a child with autism becomes an advocate to some degree, because there's so much at stake, and they you know, they care so much about helping their child. And one thing I noticed was this quick building momentum here. And at this point, I think more than 10,000 people have signed their petition, built up from a few thousand when I reported the story, because they say, you know, we just need a yes or no answer. And I started sort of pre-reporting the story out and just contacting the typical places I would reach out to, the state, to the centers, and then to these other, I'll try to just sum up what they are there. Pennsylvania has five healthcare, they're not providers, they provide the funding. They're called behavioral health managed care organizations. So I reached out to them and just said, hey, can you just tell me yes or no? Do you understand that under this policy change, you'll be able to pay out for this? Well, the three of the five that responded all said, that's a question for the state. So they said, reach out to the Department of Human Services or the state. Now I did, of course, reach out to the state. And the most recent statement I got, I have here in front of me now. Now keep in mind, I emphasize, please, whatever you say, begin your answer with yes or no. And the most recent guidance is, yes, with some caveats. And I'm not going to read you all the details because it really gets in the weeds. But what I've found is the state is unable to say unequivocally, you know, yes, we are going to be able to provide this. And I think that's why so many people are concerned is, and I think Michelle can probably speak to that as well, because it causes problems for some of the centers that are trying to do their planning right now.
Michelle, yes. Go ahead.
We are in the midst of trying to contract with behavioral health. We've been accepting private insurance for the last 8 years, and we really don't want to turn kids away. And some kids are MA only. They only get the medical assistance. And we are afraid to contract because we're a small company, and we can't go without getting paid. And in the end, what will happen is that we will not get reimbursed for our services, and we won't be able to provide them, and we could lose a lot of money and not be able to pay our staff and things of that importance. So that's why this is so important. I'm literally have the contract at my desk, and I'm afraid to sign it until I have more clear guidance on what they're going to do.
Hey, let me follow up with you, Michelle, about the coronavirus pandemic. I have read many accounts over the past few months about how children with special needs, not just autism, but maybe physical disabilities as well, have been impacted by this pandemic of maybe not getting the kind of treatment or therapy that they need. If you could, I know this is a big question, what kind of impact has the pandemic had on these kids?
Yeah, so we started the pandemic when everyone shut down. We shut down as well. And we provided some telehealth. And we found that some of our kiddos who were getting 30 hours of service in center could tolerate a half an hour to an hour worth of telehealth at a time. So they might do that twice or even three times a day. But 3 hours of service per day versus 6 hours of intensive service in our center was much different, and it was able to help us maintain some skills. We would review things. We were not able to teach a lot of new things. We were basically reviewing and maintaining skills during that time. So it was a really important goal of ours to reopen. And once we had some guidance, we reopened, and we're starting to see our kids start gaining skills again and moving forward. So we wouldn't, you know, that was very hard for it. We did lose some kiddos who had other risks of health risks, and telehealth wasn't working for them. So in that way, it was also very scary because we want to be able to provide these services to all the families, and financially having less families able to bring their child to us has made a difference. But otherwise, we're back open. We're using tons of safety protocols, and we're keeping our services available because we know how hard it is for our families to be without their services.
Kathleen, are there still kids, though, that are falling behind?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, there's, you know, families are scared to have services in some respects. So that's one aspect of the pandemic. No matter how many safety protocols you put in place, you know, families are scared and they have risks. And we are absolutely seeing kids fall behind. We are seeing kids not make progress moving forward, and more so the family dynamic that's happening in a lot of these homes with, you know, having a child with a disability, you know, being in the middle of a pandemic, trying to work from home and trying to also be a care coordinator for my kid with autism. The families are under an immense amount of stress. And we're also seeing referrals for moms and dads for marriage counseling increase. Moms and dads coming in for, you know, treatment for depression. It's very, very difficult on families. It's very difficult on all families throughout the pandemic, but very much so for those who have a child with a disability.
We're joined by one of those parents now, Danielle Rostick. Ms. Rostick, thank you very much for being with us today. Tell us about your child.
Hi, Scott. My son is 5 years old. He was diagnosed medically, of course, with autism spectrum disorder when he was around 2 years old. So we had the unique experience of not having ABA services for probably about the first 2 years of his diagnosis. We, like many other parents, were not aware what services were out there. When you're first beginning, it's kind of a minefield of, you know, just trying to figure out what your child needs, what they don't need, all of that. So it's a really big ask for these parents to really, you know, figure out what services they need, and then, you know, just the horrible, heartbreaking realization that these services are now being removed.
What's your son's name?
His name is Reese.
So before we get to the services, how is Reese doing during this time of the pandemic?
So in March, when we get services through behavior interventions in King of Prussia, and they have been absolutely a godsend to our family. We started out with them in September of 2019, and when he started his services with ABA, he was almost completely nonverbal. He would gain words, and then he would lose them, and, you know, all of a sudden he would say a sentence, and then it would be gone. It was just a constant, you know, struggle to understand him and understand what he's going through. One of the things that, you know, was mentioned is some of the skills that they gained can be, you know, anything from potty training. But for him, it was really self-advocating. So he would get hurt. Something would happen to him at, like, a daycare, and he wouldn't be able to tell us, which is horrible. It's horrible for a parent to find a bite mark on your child, and nobody can explain what happened. But in March, when they shut the center down, he was already at the point where he had gained so much that he was actually speaking in full sentences. So he was able to tell us what was going on. You know, he'd wake up and, you know, I mean, I think every parent can relate to the, you know, the first day that your child tells you that they love you. You know, mm-hmm. It's just such a huge moment for you in your life. And we had to wait, you know, almost 4 years for that to happen for us, of his life. So that was, you know, that was such a huge moment for us. So to get to the point where he was speaking in full sentences, he could wake up and tell us what he dreamt about. So, you know, he'd wake up and say, you know, Mama, I dreamed of a white giraffe, you know, like that was just so amazing to us. Like every little thing that we gain every day, we just fight so hard for. And when we March, and they had to shut down the centers, and they had to shut down a lot of the therapies, and they went virtual, and you know, we were very blessed with that. My mother-in-law lives with us, and so she's able to assist during those sessions and sit down. And even with that one-on-one support that we had in the home virtually, we could see that he was losing. He was losing. And towards the end, where the centers reopened, he had gone all the way back to where he had lost most of his words. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
It was so heartbreaking to see him slip back into silence. And the years of progress and the everything everyone had done for us, we're just so grateful. We're so grateful that we live in a state that allows for medical assistance to help us with these payments, to help this amazing, funny, like intelligent, just wonderful child. So, and for us, you know, like I said, we're very blessed. We work from home. You know, we're very safe during, you know, the COVID situation. You know, we're taking all the precautions, but other families don't have that luxury. So not only when they move the services into a home, we're sharing therapists, and these therapists, you know, first of all, it is not their jobs to risk their lives to provide their services. You know, there are so few therapists to begin with. And I think all the parents can relate to this. You know, when you get a good therapist, you're just so excited because there is a lack of therapists out there. And the lack of therapists willing and able to do home visits and the exposure that they have to less controlled environments, the center provides them with a consistent space to work, professionally cleaned service area that they can work in. And it controls how many people can, you know, like was said before, can interrupt those services and, you know, stop the learning and the growing from happening. Because, you know, when any child, you know, about, you know, preschool age, I mean, I'm sure you can imagine, you know, you're doing something with them and, you know, oh, the blue ball over there, and they run off. You know, it's even more so with children with autism. You know, this is a lot of play-based therapy. It's, you know, getting the child to really trust and know you. And then also, you know, gaining those skills as they do.
Danielle, I am so glad that we had an opportunity to hear about you and Reese's story. I'm hoping that, you know, what we've focused on here today, that there will be a little more clarity and that things can get better with this pandemic and that Reese will be able to say, I love you again, Mommy, very soon. Thank you for calling in.
No problem, Scott. I did want to say one other thing, and that is that when we're talking about this regulation that's going into effect, it sets a precedence. It sets a legal precedence for not only these children on MA to lose services, but also for private providers to then follow suit. So we're not talking about just a billing issue or a payment issue or, you know, the global pandemic or this isolated time. We're talking about actually taking away the rights of these children to individualized therapy. And that's the biggest issue here. And I think that's something that, you know, everyone should be really caring about. 1 in 68 children are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. That means that everyone listening to this call either knows someone on the spectrum or will know someone on the spectrum in their lifetime. That's a huge deal.
Daniel Rostick, thank you very much for calling in. Brett Schultes, we're almost out of time. So where does this stand, Brett? I mean, you talked earlier, but what happens next? What can we look forward to?
Scott, I'll continue following up with the state as they clarify their guidance, and hopefully we'll have an answer soon for parents and for providers here. I think that, you know, when we talk to the providers, when we talk to the managed care organizations that are responsible for issuing the funding, the payment for these services, regardless of what the state is saying, they've made it clear that they don't have enough clarity in the terms like medically necessary, in terms like group or individual need to be clarified. So I'm really glad that she called in, because she makes the stakes so clear to I think everybody, is that without that clarity, children could not get the care they need. But I'll stay on it and I'll let you know, Scott.
Thank you very much, Brett. Michelle DeMarsh, founder of the Pennsylvania Autism Action Center, Kathleen Bailey Stengel, CEO of New Abilities, and Brett Shouldis, WITS Transforming Health Reporter. Thank the three of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
The demand for green energy is only increasing as the world looks for more sustainable energy options. Solar power is one such option experiencing significant growth. In fact, Pennsylvania is on the cusp of solar development boom. There are currently more than 350 solar projects proposed in the Commonwealth in various stages of planning. Some of these projects are meeting considerable opposition in the communities where they will be built. State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Rachel McDevitt has reported on the story, and she's with us today. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Rachel, you reported there's been a rise in the number of large solar projects planned for Pennsylvania. What's driving that?
Right. Yeah. 200 projects applied to connect to the regional electric grid just last year. That our regional electric grid is PJM. And many of those would be what I would consider large, and I think a lot of other people would. That's greater than 20 megawatts. And for reference, it can take between 5 and 10 acres of land to produce a megawatt of solar power. So those are pretty big projects. But what's driving it, there are a couple of factors, according to analysts. Solar has just gotten really cheap. The panels are really cheap now, and so it's more competitive. And developers are willing to place bets that people are going to want to be able to buy this power once they have these facilities up and running, because large companies, institutions, and governments are all setting clean energy goals, and that's sending an important signal to developers that they're going to want to buy this. And I should say that, 200 projects applied last year, but not all of those projects will be built.
Even with the benefits of cheaper energy that's more environmentally friendly, not everyone is on board. Why?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. It depends. There are people pushing back because they just don't want to see solar panels. This can really be a sort of a not in my backyard or NIMBY problem. There is one community in our area, at least one, Mountjoy Township in Adams County, that's near Gettysburg. They've been debating whether to allow a solar project in their area for the last year. They're holding a series of hearings. They're scheduled out until the end of February at this point, over whether to grant a permit to this project. Some of the objections.
Okay.
From the property values, they think it will make property values go down. And they don't want to see it. They think it's going to change the character of their area. It is a historic area outside Gettysburg. They think it could affect tourism. And they're also worried somehow that the panels will affect the environment, that they could harm the environment in some way.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is an issue that you very rarely hear much about. And, everyone thinks of solar energy as being, one of the best forms of sustainable energy out there. But there are some people who think that these panels may not be environmentally friendly. What are they talking about?
Right. So the solar panels are made up of mostly like glass and silicone, but there are some components in there that are considered toxic. things like cadmium or heavy metals. And so some of the opponents to solar energy believe that these heavy metals are going to leach out of the solar panels while they are in use and contaminate the surrounding soil and groundwater. But I spoke to a scientist at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado. He studies these across the country. He said those materials are sealed in the panels. They are nearly impossible to get out. There have even been studies where people tried to burn the panels to release those heavy metals, and it did not work. So they are relatively safe. All energy has an impact, but in use, solar panels are safe. Long term, I mean, these people have a good point. I mean, long term, we will have to consider how we're handling solar panels, how we recycle them, and making sure we don't like abandon these things or just stuff them in landfills at the end of their useful life.
Yeah, that would seem to be. But by the way, before we talk about that, what is useful life for a solar panel? Do we know?
Well, the leases generally run 25 years. So that's the initial lifespan of the solar panels. But like all technology, they are improving every year. So I have heard sometimes that after like 10 years, they'll switch out the panels for a more efficient model. But I think generally developers are banking on these panels lasting 25 years.
So with the discussion of the panels having toxic materials, and as you said, they do have some materials that could be considered toxic if they were to leak. But mm-hmm. your story also mentioned that there is some misinformation and disinformation that has been put out there about solar energy, right?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, if you go to the internet with the intent of finding information that's going to support your argument that solar panels are toxic, it's easy to find. A lot of this information stems from climate deniers, from fossil fuel-backed think tanks or groups. And it's not entirely clear when you're just sort of scanning the internet and you see a lot of scary headlines, because mixed in with that disinformation is legitimate, you know, news articles about like what I was just talking about, how we do need to consider the end of life of these panels. There's, you know, information from the government that's very dry and not exactly clear that, you know, say basically that, yeah, there's toxic materials in there. Like, here's what you need to know, but they don't really have a conclusion listed underneath it. Like, but you don't really need to worry. So it can be really confusing. And I think people who are against this move to solar panels because it could take market share away from our traditional fossil fuels. And they are relying on that confusion to drive this fear of what could happen.
You mentioned earlier about municipalities granting permits. What role do local municipalities play in solar development?
Right, so municipalities are really driving solar development. Or I should say it falls to municipalities in making decisions about solar development. They have the right to decide how to zone solar, any parameters they want to put on it, like size or height, how far back it has to be from existing buildings or homes. Solar is a legal use. They have to allow it, but again, they can put those limits or restrictions on it if they would want to, you know, keep things small. Everything is really being decided at the local level right now. The state hasn't stepped in to issue uniform guidelines or a law governing how exactly these big solar developments can be put up, because much like at the beginning of the Marcellus shale boom, this is private activity. It's a private company securing a lease with a private landowner and then building it. It's just like a construction project.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Marcellus Shale, because I have to mention, I have to say that when I read your story, that's what I thought of, is early development of Marcellus Shale, because there are similarities to this in that property owners lease their land, or in some cases, lease their land to these companies that are developing. Talking about that, and how do these leases work?
I think, you know, I haven't looked at a specific lease, but basically how I've come to understand it is, and there can be several different companies involved to get one project off the ground. One company might come in and sort of scout where would be a good location for a solar project, talk to landowners, they secure leases. And then once there's sort of a critical mass, I guess, of land available in a certain area, that's when the actual developer, the builder, would come in, lay out the plans for the solar farm, and then, you know, get building, secure the required permits and build. But the leases pay landowners, they pay them a fee while they're sort of waiting for the development to come in. I think that would be described as an option. I'm not sure about the legal terms around leases. Sorry, Scott. But so they pay them while they're waiting for the development to get started. And then after the development is up, the facility is running, then they pay them a dollar amount based per acre per year over the life of the project. So people will have 25-year leases. And I've heard that the amount they get paid really varies depending on the project, on the desirability of the land, I guess. They can get paid anywhere between $300 and $2,000 an acre per year.
So this project you mentioned in Adams County, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but this was a situation where some property owners leased their property, but others didn't know about it and opposed the project. What happens in a case like that?
Well, in this case, the neighbors who are against it are fighting it, not in court necessarily. The series of hearings that's playing out, they keep referring to as a quasi-judicial series of hearings. But this group has hired a lawyer to represent them and to ask the questions, basically to streamline the process, you know, ask these questions and try to get some answers about what the project is going to look like and the impact it can have on their community. Trying to get it out on the record because they want the township supervisors to ultimately deny the permit. Because in this situation, the project, the builder, NextEra Energy Resources, they want to build in two different zoning areas. One is agricultural, which solar is an allowed use in this agricultural area, and also the Baltimore Pike Corridor. And there they need a conditional use permit. So that's what's being contested in the process in Mountjoy.
We have an email from a listener who I should mention is not in Adams County connected to this project, but the listener says, large rural acreage is the resource the solar industry requires for the establishment of the drifts of the arrays necessary to generate the petroleum-based electricity. Many individuals and families have invested their personal fortunes to live in a rural landscape. The rural landscape is radically changed and aesthetics lost by the panel's installation. Who will protect this non-renewal resource land for future generations to enjoy? That sounds like an argument that maybe some of those other property owners who oppose would make.
Yeah, I think they would definitely agree with that. They would argue. I mean, they chose to live where they do for a reason. They don't want to lose that agricultural character. They don't want to lose the views that they have from their homes. I mean, that's an argument that they should have. I mean, this is the conversation that communities need to have. What do we want to be? What do we want to preserve? What do we want to make room for? That's a legitimate conversation to have because there are other places to put solar panels. It is cheap to put solar panels on farmland, but there are other places to put them, you know, over like brownfields and parking lots and stuff like that. So it's a conversation that should be happening at this local level about what we want our communities to look like. And if residents feel like they don't have a voice, I mean, that will actually make this type of development unsustainable in Pennsylvania. If there is no community buy-in on these types of projects, it will probably make developers look elsewhere to put their projects.
Rachel McDevitt, we only have about 30 seconds. And I have to hold you to that for 30 seconds. Does the state have a role in this at all?
Not at this point, just in sort of a minimum level, they oversee projects for sediment and erosion control. But other than that, the state has not created a law governing the development of grid-scale solar at this point. They might. We'll watch.
Rachel McDevitt is WITF's State Impact Pennsylvania reporter. Rachel, great work on this, and the story will be obviously will probably come up more often. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.